Hey everybody, this is Pierre Quinn and you're listening to episode number 82 of the Leading While Green podcast, where my mission is to help you live, learn, and lead with confidence. On this episode of the podcast, I am joined by my friend Chris Bartley. Chris is the founder and owner of the Bartley Group, and we talk about his company. We talk about learning leadership while in college. We talk about what it means to be homeless. And Chris talks about this anti-hero journey. So what does it mean to be an anti-hero? Why all of us are in danger of being an anti-hero and what we can do about it? It's a great conversation. So listen up. Supporting the Leading While Green podcast. I mean, your support, your listens, your shares on social media, your reviews on Apple Podcast, they mean a huge deal. I mean, it's a big deal. Not only getting boost in the Apple Podcast algorithm, but just helping people who need some advice, some counsel, some encouragement on their leadership journey. Now, if you haven't, hop over to Apple Podcasts, leave us a 5-star review and some comments. Let other people know how much of a difference the Leading While Green podcast is making in your life. I also want to encourage you to hop over to prcquinn.com. Check out my free leadership course, 12 Tips to Grow as a Leader. Great stuff, some video content. I use it to train leaders across the country, and I'm giving it to you away for free. So check that out at prcquinn.com. And while you're there, you can jump on my leaders list and get updates from me. I'm excited about this summer. I'm locked in some engagements for the summer. So I'll be heading to the National Association for Court Management. I'll be headed to their annual conference at the Bellagio Hotel in Las Vegas doing a keynote, a closing keynote for them. So I'm really excited about that. Got a couple of other engagements in DC in the summer and really just looking to pack the calendar with opportunities to share with emerging leaders and seasoned leaders some of these principles of leadership. Also working on a follow-up to Leading While Green. I know many of you have asked about that, and the follow-up book to Leading While Green will be out this summer as well. So be on the lookout for that. Okay, my conversation today is with my good friend, Chris Bartley. We go way back to college days. And Chris has been a leader for a long time, one of the best speakers that I know. And today he is the founder and owner of the Bartley Group, where he lives to serve and inspire others through strategy and design. So we talk about his life, his journey, and what it means to be an anti-hero. This is a great conversation. So you might want to take some notes. Here's my conversation with Chris Bartley. Happy to be joined today by my good friend, Chris Bartley. Chris is the founder and owner of the Bartley Group, that works with the mission to serve and inspire others through strategy and design. Chris, thanks for joining me today.
It's my pleasure, man.
Now, Chris, man, let's just dive right in, man. Just talk to me about growing up, or not necessarily growing up, but being in a collegiate setting and being in an individual who was known to have tons of talents and skills and abilities, and how you wrestled with being a capable, skillful, talented guy on a college campus?
You don't really think about it, you know, when you're in the midst of it. When you receive a lot of affirmation, it's really just, I feel like it confirms that you do quite a few things very well, you know? And even when you're in it, not that I didn't have self-awareness, but it was just kind of the norm. You know, when you're surrounded by people like yourself who do multiple things, you know, and everyone who is, I guess they're just actively engaged. It kind of reduces you feeling as if you're like some supernatural, super gifted, you know, like, because that's the group that you're with, You know, I remember one day, a good, really good friend of mine, Anthony Willis, he took out a styrofoam plate and started writing some stuff on some sheets of paper. And he served it to me. And he says, these are all of the things that you're doing right now. To just illustrate how much I had on my literal plate, you know.
And yeah, that's great. That's a good analogy.
And it's funny because there were times when, you know, you did eventually feel like you're doing a lot. You are pulled in multiple directions. And then what that could do is make you wonder, are you overextending yourself? Are you not maximizing? That's one of my strength finders, strengths. And you're wondering, you know, are you fully utilizing one or maybe two of the areas where you can be great instead of just good versus being the jack of all, you know, trade. Mm. So it's a mixture. I really have to kind of go back into my mind and think about that, because the what I was mainly known for was spoken word. Mm-hmm. That was the main thing. I really wasn't known for some of the things that I'm doing now. And I don't think it's because they weren't activated. I just think that I don't know, maybe I downplayed them. You know, maybe I just wasn't in the space to allow for the part of those gifts or those talents to flourish. But yeah. So, but that's a very good question. I think one of the things that it does is it could, if you're not certain about what you're doing or where you're going. I mean, for me, you know, my spiritual connection was a huge part. It was a very huge part of the compass that I needed, you know, to just navigate through college years. You would kind of feel lost, even though you have a lot of gifts. And we know people like that, right? We know people who are super talented, and yet they've kind of amounted to nothing.
Hmm. So let's talk about that just a bit more, because
one of my biggest fears, by the way,
being super talented but amounting to nothing, right? And I know there's some people who are listening to the podcast who may really resonate with that, and I know I have some college students who are frequent listeners to the podcast. Talk to us about sort of your journey as a college student and kind of wrestling with where do your gifts and talents fit? Because now you have, you know, you got through undergrad, you got through grad school, you have a master's in communication. But there was a time where you were kind of like all over the place. Like, where did you go from, and how did you finally land in the discipline of communication?
Yeah. So the short version is you take what you have. Well, for me, I took what I had from high school. Right. So one of the reasons why I was an architect major first was because, you know, I was in this program, this art program in high school, and I didn't want to be the starving artist. So one of the reasons why I chose architecture was I did enjoy, you know, perspective drawing and, you know, all of that. But at the same time, I wanted to have a sustainable living. You know, so it was a mixture. And it's so funny that now that I think about it, that's just how my mindset worked. You know, I am an architect just in a different way, you know. So I love making blueprints, but now instead of it being urban planning, it's strategies for either businesses or, you know, ideas, you know, so it's different. It's the same stuff, but it's just framed differently. So I'm coming from high school, bringing that stuff in. And that's one of the starting points. I remember... and the other one is when people actually will come up to you and ask you, hey, can you do X, Y, and Z? I remember our dean, I remember it distinctly for one summer, you know, he asked me, hey, can you create a poster for me? Of course I could. I was tinkering with Photoshop back in high school when, you know, Photoshop was, you know, not even on CDs yet, kind of a thing, you know? So those two experiences where I already knew what I was good at doing. And then people kind of gave me opportunities. I remember another experience where, you know, once again, I was a part of this organization called the Pathfinder, you know, so youth group, a youth organization, Pathfinder Club, where I was great at drumming and drilling. You know, so I was a great snare drum player. So came in and experienced and found out that Andrews University had a drum corps. You know, I actually went up to one of the guys that were there at the time, you know, upperclassmen, and said, I'm going to be a part of this. You know, this was around the era that the Drumline movie came out, you know, so yeah. I'm going to be a part of this thing. And lo and behold, an opportunity was given to me to become the actual drum corps leader, you know, one of the groups on campus. So that's those are the two ways that things kind of flourished for me, was already recognizing what I had. You know, oh, and how could I forget spoken word? I remember in high school when I created my first sonnet, like the thing was like on point. You know, I'm talking about, you know, the 10 syllables, the meter being just perfect, and it makes sense, and the words rhyming at the end. I can't even remember what it's called now because it's been so long ago. But there's a literary term for that. I realized that I did have the ability not just to write, but to write creatively. You know? So a few of those experiences, you know, being aware of my gifts, bringing that into college, embracing those things, and then actually following through, you know, with individuals who, you know, and I'm going to shamelessly plug you in, man. You also were one of the people, man, who challenged me to, okay, you got Photoshop, but have you ever dealt with Illustrator?
I remember that conversation. Yeah.
And then I mastered Illustrator, and you said, okay, so how about InDesign? Like, what? And, you know, just kind of adding on, you know, to the skill set that I had and kind of challenging me. So I would break it down into three ways, you know, being aware of what I already had, you know, from before, bringing it in to college and embracing that. The other one was people giving you opportunities. And then the other one was people challenging you in spaces that either help you to grow your gift or to activate new ones, you know, that you might not have ever even would have considered otherwise. So all of that mixture, you know, the question is, you know, how did I hone in on one? Eventually you just, and I'm learning this even more now than, you know, than I did 10 years ago. You just got to choose. Sometimes multiple situations, I got to get up. It's going to be difficult for me to just sit down in one spot. So avail me the ability to walk around. So sometimes you're going to have to, sit down and say, okay, how am I going to be maximizing, right? I truly believe that there's some people who can manage one very well, two, five, 10, like I believe that that's the case. But I also believe that there sometimes are opportunities where you don't necessarily have to make the choice. It's almost as if the choice is kind of laid out for you, where you will have multiple, you know, opportunities in this one area. And I think for me, that's kind of how it happened. I had multiple opportunities. And as I was walking into those, some doors open and while other doors closed. Like, I'm no longer a drum corps instructor, you know, but now I'm at my church and I see that they need help. And it's now versus 3 years ago that I realized, okay, I think I might have the capacity now to be able to step in and to help, you know? Mm-hmm. So I would frame it into those two ways.
So how do you wrestle with then, what's your advice on wrestling with this, what's called FOMO? The fear of missing out. Like, you know, I can dabble because of my relationships or my talent or skills or connectivity, or I'm just a likable person. I have the ability to play or hang out in multiple areas. And sometimes when I do that, I find myself not being effective in any of those areas. How do you deal with people who are wrestling with that right now?
Oh, man. So the first thought that comes to mind is the master or the jack of all trades, but the master of none. I really think that let me back up a little bit. People that have the fear of missing out but have the resources to cover everything and the time to do so, go ahead and do it. Go ahead. Like, there are some people, I'm thinking of someone right now, Will Smith, who's crushing the Instagram game. Mm-hmm. And he has a bucket list. I think he has a new series now out on, I think it's just on Facebook TV, I believe. And it's just him going out and experiencing everything that he's never experienced. But he's like in his 50s now, right? Like, yes. So, you know, but before that, he was mainly or namely known for acting. right? But now he's kind of flourishing and you know, I don't know his personal life and what else he was doing, but from what we can see from media wise, you know, he's now branching out into other areas where he doesn't want to miss out. But he has the ability, right? He has the resources. He has the time to do that. I'm not saying that we don't have the time to do it, because especially if you're younger, you know, we can argue that you do have time, right? But it's the likelihood that you are going to be able to attack everything, you know, with the same amount of energy, the same amount of intention. I'm learning now, that's not realistic. Something is going to give, right? So the advice that I have for somebody who is experiencing FOMO is, no mo. No mo FOMO. Right? Because at the end of the day, and I can only speak for myself, you know, it's very tricky. I think I've had that fear, but I never walked into it, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. There are people who, you know, I feel like sometimes I talked as if I didn't know what was going to happen, or, you know, and then next week, you know, I'm executing something like, you know, like, but weren't you just depressed about, you know, this whole thing here? But then, you know, so for me personally, it's either making the choice, right? Just making the decision, like, okay, I might miss out here, but what's actually in front of me right now that I can take care of?
Yeah.
What door has already been opened versus trying not to waste time struggling to find keys to the other doors that you see in front of you when there's already one that's wide open, you know? So the best teacher for that, though, and it's sad to say, but if you don't learn from other people, the best teacher for FOMO is regret. Hmm. When you look back and see the opportunities that were open, or, you know, the one that you should have maximized on, but because you tried to cover everything, you look back in your life and say, wow, you know what? If I had only honed in one or two, perhaps. And I don't want that. I don't want that fear of regret. So, you know, my FOMO has turned into a FROMO, fear of regretting missing out. I don't know. Yeah.
If you put it on a t-shirt, people will buy it. So, so part of what you have been talking about a bit, especially when we look at the example of Will Smith, is able to do certain things in his life because you can see there is a plan and he's being strategic. Not only is he being strategic in how he accomplishes them, but he's being strategic in how he lets the rest of the world know what he's doing. So talk to us about the importance of strategy and how you came to resonate with this and how this really, really undergirds what you're doing with the Bartley Group. I almost said the Cardell Group, with the Bartley Group.
So this is an interesting thing. I realized that, you know, the first thing with the strategy is you have to be, and I'm going to come back to this idea of awareness or seeing a problem or a challenge and then being able to tackle it or using it as an opportunity. Now, you know, in the business world, you know, you can consider that SWOT, you know, you have the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. And I'm going to use this one particular instance that happened with Will Smith. And you probably remember this too, when he was bungee jumping and they caught him free falling upside down. And because, you know, he didn't have the hair dye that day, you know, he had the gray, the salt and pepper. And he looked very much like James Avery or Uncle Phil from Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. And so social media went to town with the memes, right? They did the whole, you know, split screen where they have Uncle Phil on one side and Will Smith on the other side. And a lot of people were, let me go back. So after that experience happens, Will Smith was eventually asked about, you know, well, how do you feel about that, right? And he said something which a lot of people kind of didn't get at the time. And I believe I was looking at the comments on YouTube where he was explaining to them, this is a different space that we're in where the people, your fans, now kind of consider you as friends and they can talk to you directly. And it almost seemed as if he was skirting around the issue of him looking like Uncle Phil, but he saw the bigger picture. There was now this, I might be using this image probably throughout this entire session, but he saw this door that was just kicked in, where social media has blurred the lines between the mystery of celebrities, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah. what their fans really didn't know what was happening. And so you were almost kind of forced as a celebrity to choose not to say anything, right? Mm-hmm. Or to engage with them. Will Smith chose to engage. And so while people in the comments were like, yo, what is he talking about? This dude is, you know, he missed the entire question. I thought he actually realized it. And I believe, I could be wrong, that at that point, he probably created a strategy to start connecting directly with his fans and giving them what they wanted. And so now he has another stream of revenue, right? Like, my man is, you know, like I said, he's killing the Instagram game right now, and now also Facebook. And so when you think about strategy, that would be the first thing, right? I wouldn't even start with the threats, because I think sometimes you create strategies as a, from a reactive standpoint. I'm like, oh my goodness, if I don't create a plan, something is going to happen. Look at what Smith did, right? He said, okay, wow, hold on, wait a minute. I can either choose to continue being like the Denzel Washington and the Beyoncés, who, by the way, they can still continue to do what they're doing because they have the brand equity to do so. Mm-hmm. Up and coming celebrities now can't do that, right? They don't have the luxury of being in the mystery, right? Like, it just doesn't work. So he decided, I'm going to step out from behind the curtain, right? And I'm going to show you what my life looks like. And the whole Red Table Talks with his family, like that, yo, it's crazy, right? So all of that to say, he starts to create now this strategy around what has already been forming, kind of been churning in the waters of media and the internet. So for me, it's very similar. The reason why now I'm focusing on healthcare design and marketing is because I had an opportunity. I worked with a particular company, and it was first with user experience design projects, very small too, you know, like doing buyer personas and being able to interview, you know, their demographic. And I realized that I had a knack for asking critical questions. Like, I created the interview questions myself. I combined all of the data, created a narrative. I'm great with also creating narratives. You know, so using these pieces, I was able to create or really freelance as a UX designer, as a copywriter. Like, these are things that I've already been doing, but now an opportunity afforded me to do it in one particular industry. And so when people ask me, so why healthcare? My answer is, that's where my first opportunity started. like there's no other way. And so if things get bigger for me, I can definitely branch out. And so then we go from healthcare to IT, or maybe from IT to, I don't know, CPGs, you know, consumer product goods. Like, I don't know. We'll see. The point is, I started with the opportunity that was afforded me, and that was in the healthcare space. And so now what I'm doing is I'm leveraging the gifts that I have and now being more proactive. So what does that, because, you know, usually when you talk about words like strategy and, you know, any other, you know, buzzwords that's kind of around that theme, it seems very abstract, you know. Mm-hmm. For me, strategy, I like using Michael Porter's definition, if I can even remember it properly, but strategy is choosing where it is that you want to play and where you don't want to play. That's it. And it's really saying no to the places that you're not going to work in, FOMO, right? Yeah. So you're choosing not. And that's why for those who have a strategy that is very weak, it's because you're trying to play in multiple markets, right? And he specifically said it's places that you are not going to play in. And the ones that you're choosing to play in, and I like the fact that he uses the word play, because, you know, when it comes in that, in this realm, which I'm learning a lot of, it's very, you know, they like to use words competition and playing, and, you know. Long story short, you have to now decide, are the spaces that I'm playing in, are they worth playing in? Is it feasible? You know, are my stakeholders, you know, going to back me up in this thing, and, you know, all of that. So, yeah, so that's that would be my kind of just the journey of how I've gotten. That's the short version, actually, because, as you know, I have pivoted many a times, but I realized I've been pivoting often in like the same spaces. So instead of trying to fight it, you know, I'm just going to embrace the industry that I'm in and move forward. And I was also a behavioral health specialist, right? So that's another thing too that I was able to bring into my business. So because I started using, we call it EHR, electronic health record software, that was just atrocious, the UX part of me was like, oh my gosh, how can people use this stuff? This is terrible. Okay, so now I've created a business where my first order of business right now is to help hospitals and clinics to adopt new EHR software, which means that I have to connect with the CMO or the CIO, the chief information officer, and to help them to figure out and to understand that a new EHR adoption can help a few things: patient experience design, provider workflow. And so it's still UX, but it's packaged differently, you know? So yeah, use those opportunities. So even the things that frustrate you the most, I would say build a strategy around that. And that's what I started doing.
Let's talk about this experience of being a behavioral specialist and how that really triggered the design part and the strategy part of you to pivot and to seek additional opportunities. Man, it's some parts of your story that I think our listening audience, man, would benefit from. Like, what, talk to us about that section of life, that section of discovery that was happening while you right before and during the time you worked as a behavioral specialist.
Excuse me. So it started with a chair. I was driving in Miami a few years ago and started to have a heart for the people who are actually homeless, like, you know, just in my area. And I had this idea, you know what? What if these guys, you know, what if these people just needed a place, not just to sit, right? Because a lot of them, they may not have, you know, anything to really just rest their legs on. What if they had an opportunity to sit, but then also to share their story? And so I went out, got a foldable chair, and my goal was to have homeless people sit in the chair, say whatever they want to say, like just share your life, do whatever you want to do. And when you're done, I just ask two things. Can I record, you know, you sharing your story, because I would want other people to hear it. And then number two, can you just go ahead and sign the chair? So my vision was at the end of, I don't know, the quarter or month, whatever, you know, this chair would be filled with signatures, which would, you know, just kind of represent how many individuals have, you know, these unspoken stories that people might have either forgotten or just would have never known, you know, had they not sat in that chair and had, you know, for a brief moment, this sense of regality to, you know, just say what they want to say, almost like going into the barbershop, right? You know, you sit on the throne for those, you know, 30, 45 minutes, and you tell the barber exactly how you want, what you want, you know, and that's, you know, and then the experience is over. A few months later, it was very short, not even like two signatures in, I felt called to go to New York City, and without any plan, which is very, like, that's uncharacteristic of, right, to just go somewhere without a plan or strategy, to go there and to just see what happens. Like, I literally had no plan. So that's exactly what I did. I went ahead, and long story short, I became homeless. And in that process, I started to connect with individuals who had been homeless for almost 20 plus years. And I had to ask myself, how is it that this one guy, Scott, with a JD, or another one with a CDL license, or guys who are getting annuities every January but are blowing it off, so that by the time, you know, just a month is over, they find themselves at square one? How is it that you end up in the same spot, or you have, like, you've got the intellectual, you know, I would call it IP. Y'all got some intellectual property. You've got the capability to think your way out of this thing if you wanted to, and you choose not to. And I found out, because eventually I was experiencing it through the process, was this issue of shame, you know, not wanting to go back into your community for whatever the reason is, or to your family, because of having gone through whatever it is that you've gone through. Now, I had previously gone through, I call it, and we're gonna talk about that, a shaming or humiliation incident about maybe 2 years prior to going to New York City. And I always used to associate me going to New York City and being homeless to my past. But I'm starting to understand those are two separate things. But what happens is, if you never get over your shameful experience, anything that is unfortunate that's happening to you, you will always connect to, well, you know, this is just karma, you know, well, you know, and And I realized that that wasn't the case at all. So long story short, I almost got comfortable in my homelessness to the point where I said, hey, this isn't that bad at all. You mean to tell me that if you're really rich or you're really poor, the middle class takes care of you? You know, tax-wise, like, why would I even want to work out of this to get into the middle in order to be stretched thin? Like, this is the philosophy that I had almost adopted, because a lot of, as particularly men in this position, that's what they did, right? They truly believe that, you know, it's easier to just get the handouts, right? And to stay in this space and nobody really bothers you. You know, you just kind of live your life. Yeah, not really much in any purpose per se. You're just existing. So I also found out that a large part of this reason was because of chronic mental illness. So during this time, I actually didn't finish my master's yet. So, I mean, we're going on like 6 years, right? So, and I'm already working for myself, right? I was already a freelancer, like money's rolling in. And I figured, well, why would I need to finish school? Nobody's asking for my degree. So what's the purpose? So if anything, going through that experience, if nothing else came out of it, I actually graduated because of it. What happened was I started, you know, I got back on board, Dr. Stang, wow, shout out to Dr. Stang. Even after she retired, she still followed up with me. She was an emeritus at this point, and she still followed up to make sure that I had finished school. And I was able to use what I framed because of my homeless experience called the anti-hero's journey. And in the anti-hero's journey, there were 7 steps that I had developed to help you to reframe your shaming experience. So first you had to reframe that experience, and then you had to regard it, you had to own it, and then you had to rebuild from the experience that you're, or move on from the experience that has happened. So the first step is reservation. You know, you have to understand and to believe. And this is where it's definitely a spiritual component, because I quite frankly believe that I'll put it this way. My personal worldview is from a crystal-centric philosophy. So anything that happens, the root, the source, the real, right? I don't know what they call it in philosophy. You probably can help me out with this. What is the one that's real? You know, what's real, what's true, and what's of value. Is it epistemology? No, that's truth. Anyway, I can't remember. Long story short, right? The first thing is you have to understand that you are reserved for a purpose. Now, some people can, you know, rationalize and say, you know, even from a naturalistic standpoint, you can do that yourself. You know, you can come to that realization yourself. It's within you. And, you know, you can draw that out. Okay, cool. Fine. Whatever. But the point is, you have to know that you are put on this earth for a purpose. Mm-hmm. You just weren't created to die. You know, the second thing is step two is awareness. You have to recognize, and these are all R's, you know, alliteration makes it a little bit easier to understand, to recognize that you are reserved for a purpose. Step one, you may not recognize, right? It's step two that you actually realize, oh, wait, hold on, step one is real. You know, so it's kind of, you're looking backwards. And then here is where, you know, you have what's called the hero's journey. You know, Joseph Campbell talks about this. And where we deviate from the hero's journey, which is typically, I'm going to summarize it in 3 steps. There's a call, there's a refusal of the call, and then there's the actual acceptance of the call. And when you accept the call, you kind of go on to the, you know, the rest of the hero's journey. Step three is where you become the anti-hero. So the anti-hero is a person who is still the protagonist of the story, but they live their lives in a villainous way. Right. So they
Hold on. I think a lot of people listening to the podcast were just like, wait, what? I've never heard of this anti-hero concept. And wait a minute. You're telling me I can be the protagonist in the story, but in my personal narrative, but live my life under the guise or mask or movements of actually the villain of my own story. Kind of that. Give us that definition again, so we don't lose it.
So the anti-hero is someone who's traditionally the protagonist, right? They're the person who's still the main character of the story, but they do things, they make decisions kind of in the gray area. They untraditionally succeed as the protagonist. So they typically will do not so honorable things. They may make not so honorable decisions and, you know, do not so honorable actions, but they'll still come out, at least from the literary standpoint, as anti-heroes. So usually vigilantes like Batman, you know, would be considered an anti-hero. Not the good Batman. We're talking about, you know, like the Dark Knight, right? Another one is Robin Hood, stealing from the rich to give to the poor. Now, the way that he's providing for the poor, he's providing, which is great, but the way that he's doing it isn't as honorable as someone like Superman, right? Who's a pristine, like, classic hero. Another one is, for those who watched The Wire, I've never watched it, but apparently The Wire, as my understanding is, he was like the urban Robin Hood, right? It was like a more contemporary version of that. So anywho, that's what the anti-hero is. You're not the villain yet. If you continue along a particular path, it's likely that the antagonist of the story eventually becomes you. And that's a whole other, you know, it's a whole other section. But there still is somebody who's warring against you as the antagonist. And usually that person is you, but that's, you know, we don't want to get too deep into that. You become the anti-hero when you enter step three, rebellion. It's when you know and you recognize that you are here for a particular purpose. You do recognize your gifts, right? That's in step two as well. But you start using those things selfishly for your own personal gain. That's when you become the anti-hero. So I'm going to kind of rush this because I don't want to, you know, I know we're on time here. But the fourth step is ruination. You rebel enough until you hit rock bottom. And after you hit rock bottom, you kind of swing between stages three and four. Rebellion, ruination. Because eventually when you hit rock bottom, you say, well, this is who I am anyway, so I'm going to continue to rebel. So you continue rebelling, and then you hit another level of rock bottom. And you keep doing this until step five, which is you get tired of being tired. You know, you get tired of being the bad person, or you get tired of living the negative narrative, right? And so it's like the upswing to what we call repentance, like, which literally means to turn around. Like, okay, I'm ready. I'm ready to change my life. But that's just the mindset. Stage six is the tactical things that you need to do to actually change. Do you need an accountability partner? You know, do you need a routine? What boundaries do you need to specifically set for yourself so that you don't repeat the cycle and going back into stage three of rebellion? And then stage seven is just living the reformed life as an anti-hero. So you are still an anti-hero, but you are using your story so that when you find people slipping from stage two to three of rebellion, you can reach out to them before they hit stage four in ruination and tell them, hey, listen, I've been there. I know what that's like. You know, oftentimes what we end up doing is, you know, we go through our shameful experiences and we want to forget about it. It's happened to me for a while. You know, you just want to forget about you even having been that person or having done those things. But you're losing major opportunities to help other people who are going down the same path that you did. So the paradigm is really supposed to be preventative, you know, so that you can pinpoint where people are, right? And to help them not reach stage four. But it can also be interventive, I guess would be the word, where, you know, somebody's in stage four. How do you get them out of that, you know, and to sustain them as being a fully restored anti-hero in stage seven. So I know that was a mouthful, but long story short, man, I use that paradigm to actually graduate with my master's. So This entire paradigm was even submitted. I connected with somebody all the way in Oregon State Penitentiary. They used that over there. I got great feedback from it. Like, a lot of great things happened because of the homeless experience. And so I, in essence, sat in a chair myself. Remember, I came to Miami wanting to have homeless people sit in a chair. Well, I had to sit in a chair. And because of that chair experience, I knew what it was like to not just be homeless, not just to experience shameful experiences, but to also realize that if you replay a shameful, degenerative narrative long enough, you could have mental illness. And so that was part of my research. And I also learned the difference between shame and humiliation. Humiliation is a corrective. It's an experience that is to encourage a corrective behavior. Like, that's what it's supposed to do. So Pierre, you end up, you know, going to work late, and your boss calls you out on it, he calls you out on your lateness, not your character, on your lateness, and he uses that to kind of, you know, have you just kind of motivate you to start being more punctual. Mm-hmm. Shaming is you coming in late and he's now talking about you as a person. You know, you're a loser for coming late. Why are you doing this? Like, you know, and what happens is the shaming part really comes on us, not the experience that happens. So we start feeding these negative narratives in ourselves, in our psyche. And that's when the shaming part comes. Because the shame is the degenerative narrative about who you are as a person, your character, not your actions. So anyway, the people that I worked with, that's what they dealt with. All of that to say, man, finished the master's, went ahead and was able to secure a job with in behavioral. I was helping people with chronic mental illness with their vocational rehab. A lot of people kind of had episodes that had them fall out, you know, of their normal lives. And so a lot of them have, you know, degrees and whatnot, but because of whatever happened to them traumatically, you know, they have this, you know, just this chronic illness that kind of plagues them. So my goal and my job is to help to rebuild, right? Kind of restore, you know, that confidence in them, work with their employers. And so that's part of the whole, that's part of the whole process.
Oh, what listening to you describe the stages of the anti-hero's journey, I kind of feel like it's just more the application of it is just more than a person's personal narrative. I see how this conversation can be beneficial for entrepreneurs in the life cycle of their business. I see how it can be beneficial for corporations, for nonprofits, because just working with different organizations, and I know you have as well, you've seen how an organization can end up being the villain in its own story. Yeah. It starts to develop some negative practices, mm-hmm. and then continues to spiral. Can you speak to possibly, before we run out of time, the application of this just beyond my personal edification and personal transformation, but maybe in a corporate context or a nonprofit context, can we see some of these same character progressions?
Yeah. One of the biggest ones is as a leader, especially if you have tasted success before. One of the things that you can fall subject to is if you've had a major account that might have floundered, or, you know, you might have done some unethical business practices, you would kind of be deemed in stage four, you know, and that shameful experience can prevent you from becoming once again the, let's say, top exec that you once, you know, was, or, you know, just the thriving entrepreneur that you might have been. And that could be challenging, because even though, you know, God might be forgiving, right? Even though the people in the institution or the machine or the corporation could be forgiving, a lot of times the actual system itself isn't. It's very unlikely that if you committed, you know, embezzlement fraud, that you're going to be a treasurer, or you're going to be, you know, anywhere near a financial, right, position again. So then you have to ask yourself, well, is my life ruined? Like, if that's the only thing that I knew how to do, like, if that was the only gift that I had and I misused it, you know, how do I get out of that? You know, what is it that I do? I don't have the answer to that. But what I do know is that you still reserved for a purpose. Right. And even if you misuse that purpose, there is something that you can do to help, you know, regain that. OK, so that's that part. The other part is this. There are people who have, and this is the preventative side, who have gifts, who have skills, and they're just not using it the way that they should use it. I'm not talking about negatively. I'm saying you have these things, but for some reason or another, you're FOMOing your life away. Right. You're doing other things versus the thing that you know you should be doing. I would suggest that you are living in rebellion. You know, you're rebelling against the hero calling that only you can provide. And here's what happens to the hero who continuously rejects his calling. They become the villain of the story. Right? And so you end up attacking the very people who probably have the same gift that you have, but you end up becoming bitter, you become resentful, you start sabotaging the very people in your industry or in your position where you should have been because you didn't take up that mantle. So there it's definitely applicable in multiple industries and areas, not just a spiritual one, but definitely from a corporate one as well.
Yeah, listen, we need like two more hours, man.
We do.
Just speak to the tendency for individuals. And both of you and I have talked over the years and have wrestled with this in some capacity ourselves, the tendency of individuals who are not using their gifts and talents and abilities to the capacity that they're called to use them. But then when you see others exercising what they've been given, and maybe what they're demonstrating is not to the level or specificity or capability of you, but because you're not doing it, you kind of put them on a chopping block and you over critique and you tear it down while at the same time not building or not doing the very thing that you see in them that they're doing. Kind of take us out to the end of our conversation on that piece.
It usually starts out with the statement, I could do that. Right. I could have been, you know, I've been there. And the only thing that I can say is when you're not focusing on your purpose, you start focusing on other people's. When you're not focusing on your narrative, the only other energy that you're doing is focusing on the narratives of others. So you really have so much time to worry about other people's lives. One of the biggest challenges that I have is comparing my lives to other people. And I realize that I do that when I don't feel I'm up to snuff or up to par with what I'm doing. Whether it's because I totally, you know, just kind of avoided a particular area of my life that I know I should be engaged in, or for some reason I feel like I haven't reached that level yet. So let me see what my boys are doing. Let me see how they live in their lives, you know? And both of those can be very dangerous when it comes to living my life, right? Because I'm focusing on what my boys are doing, right? What my colleagues are doing in this space, because, you know, I know that they're succeeding. And I'm also now focusing on other people who could be where I could be, right? Because I'm neglecting my gift or my talent or the skills that's necessary to be where they are. So avoid those two. That's the only advice that I can give. Once you start focusing on your own story and staying in your own lane, the paths of other people grow dim. Now you may cross intersections with their paths. It's great. You can partner with them. That's great. But yeah, what you end up start doing is you start to live vicariously through them, either through bitterness or sabotage. And you want to make sure that none of those things happen.
Chris, where can we keep up with you, man? Give us your social media stuff, or how do we connect with the Bartley Group? What types of projects do you want people to reach out to you about? I'm going to tell everybody, listen, if you're looking for a strategist, you know, you got to reach out to Chris. Now you got to pay him. All right. He's got to eat and live indoors and travel and all of that stuff. So yeah, talk to us how to get in touch with you and the type of projects you're interested in. Or maybe let's do the type of projects you're interested in talking with people about, and then how to get in touch with you.
Okay, so right now I'm focused on healthcare marketing and design. So I'm looking at hospitals, clinics who are focusing on patient experience design. So what that means is we're trying to help them to improve their touch points between the provider, physician, doctor, and the patient, right? And the main way that I'm trying to do this right now is through EHR adoption. So you're talking about like big projects, you know? That's one. The other is I still have a heart for helping people who may have an idea, but need to figure out if it's business worthy or just a hobby. So I do business modeling, but that's very minimal now because of all of the time that's focused on the business. And where you can find me is the Bartley Group. You just put that in anywhere, and you'll be able to find me. Bartley.group is the website. And if you want the personal, it's BXRTLEY. So just the X in place of the A on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, anywhere, and you'll find me.
And Chris didn't mention it. I'll go ahead and mention it, man. He's an incredible speaker, presenter, facilitator. So if you're looking for a speaker, presenter, facilitator on any of the topics that we have talked about in terms of purpose, in terms of mission, in terms of spirituality, in terms of strategy, design, communication, Chris is definitely a person to consider bringing in to talk to your team or your group. Chris, man, thanks for taking some time out of your busy schedule to chat with me. I know I've been better for the conversation, and I know our audience will be better for it as well.
Pierre, man, it was my pleasure, man. Thank you.
Great conversation with my friend Chris Bartley from the Bartley Group. And I want you to check him out. That's why I put all of his information in the show notes. Now, Chris is great with strategy. He's great with design. He's an excellent communicator. He's a great speaker and a person that can come in and talk to your team about getting to the next level and your process. So I put his links in the show notes, and I hope you took a lot of notes. If not, shame on you. Go back and listen to it again. All right. Okay. Maybe I'm just kidding. But that's all I got for this episode of the Leading Wild Green podcast. You know, it's my mission to help you live, learn, and lead with confidence. So until next time, take care and God bless.